Neon in the lab, midnight on the clock. We set that warm line and we let it drop. Same cell, same gate, but the world rewinds.
Welcome to Base by Base, the MaperCast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So have you ever wondered why a common cold virus usually just stays put right in your nose?
Right, giving you the standard sniffles and a sore throat.
Exactly. But then occasionally, out of nowhere, it triggers this severe gastrointestinal distress. It's a pretty massive physiological leap when you think about it.
Oh, absolutely. It's a completely different environment down there.
Yeah, so think of your body as like this massive complex building equipped with a highly advanced integrated smart security system.
I like that analogy.
Thanks. So you have the cooler, well-ventilated upper floors, which is your respiratory tract. Mm-hmm. And then you have this hot active furnace down in the basement, which is the gastrointestinal core.
Right, the GI tract.
Yeah, and a virus is basically an intruder. You're just wandering the halls, looking for a room with the exact right temperature, environmental conditions to set up shop and initiate replication.
And historically, we've kind of assumed the GI tract was just a passive victim in all this.
Right. But in this deep dive, we are exploring the molecular mechanisms that actually control this security system. We're looking at how the actual developmental age of your cells, combined with your core body temperature, dictates whether that intruder gets locked out completely or, well, takes over the entire floor.
Fridging it as an integrated security system is, it perfectly captures the dynamics at play here. Because for decades, the assumption was that the gut was just dealing with collateral damage.
Like it wasn't a direct target.
Exactly. We viewed enteric symptoms during a respiratory infection as secondary inflammatory fallout. We didn't really think of it as localized security protocols failing under very specific conditions.
Well, today we celebrate the work of Alexander Sinowik, Christoph Pierre, and a huge international team from institutions like Jagiellonia University, Amsterdam UMC, and the Yale School of Medicine. Their paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences has just fundamentally shifted our understanding of this.
It really has. They've totally changed how we view endemic coronaviruses interfacing with human intestinal tissue.
And it's not like the idea of coronaviruses in the gut is totally brand new, right?
No, not at all. I mean, the virology community has long recognized that coronaviruses possess this deep evolutionary capacity to just devastate enteric systems.
Right, especially in animals.
Yeah, if we look at agricultural impacts, there's the porcine epidemic diarrhea virus, PEDV. It routinely decimates swine populations by aggressively targeting the intestinal lining.
Wow, just completely destroying the gut.
Exactly. And similar coronaviruses heavily impact bovine and feline populations too. So the capability for direct enteric infection is, you know, thoroughly conserved across the whole viral family.
Okay, let's unpack this because I have to push back on the evolutionary logic here just a bit.
Sure, go ahead.
We are talking specifically about HCoV-229E today, right?
Yeah. Oh.
That's an endemic human coronavirus that was isolated way back in 1966.
Yep, the classic common cold.
Right. And it's highly adapted to the upper respiratory tract. If its primary transmission vector is respiratory droplets, and its optimal replication environment is the cooler mucosa of the nasal cavity, why on earth would it retain the molecular keys to infiltrate the human gut?
That is the big question.
I mean, the stomach pH is completely hostile. The enzymatic environment is drastically different. Is this just some weird evolutionary accident, or is there a conserved structural vulnerability in our gut that the virus is actively exploiting?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it is less an evolutionary accident and more a testament to the broad tropism inherent in the viral spike protein itself.
Tropism meaning its ability to infect different cell types.
Exactly. Coronaviruses are remarkably plastic.
Yeah.
The cellular receptors they utilize in the respiratory epithelium often have structural homologs or are just heavily co-expressed down in the intestinal epithelium.
Oh, I see. So the door locks are similar.
Precisely. The delay in proving this for 229E wasn't a lack of theoretical basis. It was a profound methodological limitation.
Meaning we just didn't have the tools to test it properly in the lab.
Right. Because traditional 2D immortalized cell lines, you know, cells grown flat in a plastic dish, they completely failed to recapitulate the complex polarized architecture of the actual human gut.
So to determine whether this respiratory virus could genuinely hijack the gut, the team had to subject it to the exact three-dimensional environment it would face in vivo.
Yeah, they had to recreate the gut in the lab. And they did this using human intestinal enteroid, or HIEs.
Wait, so we are literally growing tiny human intestines in a dish and giving them a cold?
We literally are, yeah. They grow these directly from patient-derived LGR5 positive stem cells.
That is wild.
It is. And the utilization of ACEs is what makes this data so incredibly robust. These are not just homogeneous, boring cell populations.
Right. They're not all identical clones.
Exactly. These stem cells differentiate to form a polarized epithelium. They have enterocytes, mucin-secreting goblet cells, Paneth cells, enteroendocrine cells. They actually self-assemble into complex crypt villus architectures, just like a real gut.
That's amazing. And crucially, the team didn't just use one type. They sourced these enteroids from three distinct developmental stages, right?
Yes. They used fetal, pediatric, and adult donors.
And that developmental aspect is the core of the smart security system we mentioned in the hook.
Absolutely.
The team validated the maturation of these tiny guts by measuring transepithelial electrical resistance, or TEER.
Right, which basically measures how tight the barrier is between the cells.
Yeah, and the adult-derived tissues naturally exhibited the highest TEER, reflecting peak barrier integrity, mature tight junctions, all of that. While the fetal tissues presented significantly lower resistance profiles.
They're just leakier, biologically speaking. And setting up these distinct developmental cohorts allowed the team to test a very specific variable, which was physiological temperature.
Ah, the climate control zones of our building analogy.
Exactly. They cultured these fully differentiated enteroids at 32 degrees Celsius, which mimics the cooler environment of the upper respiratory tract.
Where you breathe in the cold air.
Right. And then they also cultured them at 37 degrees Celsius, reflecting the warmer core temperature of the gastrointestinal tract.
So they have the different ages and the different temperatures. And when they introduced the viral cohorts to these different environments, the results were just immediate.
Strikingly immediate.
They tested four endemic seasonal coronaviruses, right? NL63, OC43, HKU1, and our main suspect, 229E.
Yes, and the results were all over the map. NL63 was only able to establish infection in the fetal enteroids.
Okay.
OC43 and HKU1 just failed entirely across all the models. They couldn't get in at all.
But 229E was the outlier. It demonstrated really robust infection.
Yeah, the disparity between, say, NL63 and 229E in this specific tissue model really comes down to receptor utilization and protease availability.
Let's break that down. So receptors are the specific locks the virus needs to turn.
Right. NL63 utilizes ACE2, which we all know from COVID-19.
Right, exactly.
What 229E utilizes AMPEP, or aminopeptidase N. And AMPEP is incredibly abundant on the apical surface, the top-facing surface of mature intestinal enterocytes.
Okay, so the door is covered in the exact lock that 229E has the key for.
Exactly. But finding the target receptor is only the first step. The virus still requires host proteases to cleave its spike protein.
Basically, to prime it so it can fuse with the cell membrane and dump its genetic material inside.
Right. And the team ran experiments with endosomal pathway inhibitors, drugs like E64 and bethylamycin A1.
To see if the virus was getting swallowed whole by the cell into an endosome?
Exactly. And those drugs had absolutely zero effect on 229E replication.
Oh, wow. So it wasn't using that pathway at all?
Nope. But when they introduced camastep methylate, viral replication was drastically attenuated.
So that confirms 229E is entirely dependent on host surface serine proteases, things like TMPRS2. It just bypasses the whole endosomal entry route completely in this tissue.
Which is a huge finding. It illustrates how efficiently 229E is tuned to this specific cellular microenvironment in the gut.
It's essentially a master key situation. But when we look at the temperature data, that's where the behavior of the virus gets really crazy.
Oh, it's striking.
At 32 degrees Celsius, the cooler respiratory temperature, 229E successfully infected up to 22% of the enterocytes across all age groups, fetal, pediatric, and adult.
It just went wild. It replicated massively and shed infectious progeny exclusively from the apical surface, basically maintaining the cellular polarity.
And that uniform susceptibility at 32 degrees kind of makes sense, right? The innate cellular sensors, like the ARID-GI-like receptor pathways, they simply failed to trigger at that lower temperature.
Yeah. The virus benefits from complete immune ignorance there. It replicates without initiating the standard interferon cascades.
The host cell doesn't even know it's under attack.
Exactly. The lower temperature fundamentally suppresses the host antiviral response, which perfectly facilitates those widespread upper respiratory symptoms we associate with the common cold.
You just get the sniffles while the virus parties.
Right. But the real narrative pivot happens when the environment shifts to 37 degrees Celsius.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because at 37 degrees, the adult enteroids exhibited near total resistance to the virus.
Total shut.
Yet the fetal enteroids, and notably one of the pediatric enteroid lines, they remained highly permissive. They continued to support robust viral replication at the higher temperature.
What's fascinating here is that the resistance in the adult tissue is not just a product of that higher baseline tier measurement.
Right. It's not just a physically stronger wall.
No, it's so much more elegant than that.
Right.
The researchers utilized bulk RNA sequencing to map the transcriptomic landscape of these cells.
So basically looking at which genes are turned on and off.
Right. And it revealed that at 37 degrees, the mature adult cells undergo a profound biological reprogramming. They trigger this massive metabolic shift, rapidly upregulating pathways associated with lipid metabolism and hypoxia responses.
Like they're preparing for a siege.
Exactly.
But it's not just the protective pathways they upregulate. The most effective defensive mechanism relies heavily on what they aggressively downregulate.
Yes, the suppression is key.
The RNA-seq data showed a massive suppression of genes associated with ribosomal assembly, specifically the NOP56-associated pre-rRNA complex.
Right, and NOP56 is a critical component for large ribosomal subunit biogenesis.
So to use an analogy, the adult gut at 37 degrees is like a factory manager who realizes a thief has broken in and is trying to use their assembly line to build weapons.
I love this.
Right, so instead of fighting the thief directly, the manager just cuts the power in the factory floor.
That is exactly what happens.
Yeah.
By suppressing NOP56, the adult enterocyte essentially initiates a localized translation shutdown.
The virus manages to enter the cell, it uncoats its RNA, and it just finds an environment completely devoid of the functional ribosomal machinery it needs to synthesize its replicase complex.
The cellular logic here is brilliant. Mature enterocytes, they have the metabolic flexibility to sustain this temporary translational halt.
They can hold their breath, basically.
Exactly. They leverage the upregulated lipid oxidation and hypoxia pathways to survive the energetic bottleneck while literally starving the virus of host machinery.
Wow. And the fetal cells just can't do that.
Right. Fetal cells are biologically locked into a state of rapid proliferation and tissue expansion.
They simply cannot afford to halt ribosome biogenesis. If a fetal cell shuts down its translational machinery, it risks immediate apoptosis. It would just die.
Yes. So the fetal tissue keeps the NOP56 complex active at 37 degrees, which inadvertently leaves the metabolic door wide open for the virus to hijack the assembly line.
That is incredible. This perfectly elucidates that temperature and developmental age restriction. The adult gut utilizes its maturity to enact a transcriptomic scorched earth policy that younger tissue simply hasn't developed the capacity to tolerate.
It's a beautiful defense mechanism.
So what does this all mean in a clinical context? Because this molecular mechanism directly underpins a very common epidemiological observation, right?
No, absolutely. Neonates and young children frequently present with severe diarrheal outbreaks secondary to respiratory viral infections.
Right. They get a cold and then a stomach bug right after.
Yes. And this study explains why. Their intestinal epithelium literally lacks the transcriptomic maturity to enact this localized thermal restriction. They can't shut off the factory power yet.
This raises, well, actually, I'll let you say it because it's a huge point.
Yeah, this raises an important question about the human gut acting as a persistent viral reservoir.
Right, because if the virus is hiding there.
Exactly. If younger populations or even adult individuals with specific transcriptomic vulnerabilities, if they support replication in the GI tract, the intestine becomes a site for prolonged viral shedding.
Totally independent of whether their nose is cleared up.
Precisely. Independent of upper respiratory clearance.
The logistics of the virus actually reaching the lower GI tract are fascinating in their own right, too.
They really are, because the stomach is essentially an acid bath.
Right. Gastric acid readily inactivates unprotected virions, but our respiratory system produces all this heavily glycosylated mucus when we're sick, and that mucus actually traps the virus.
And we swallow a lot of it.
We do. When that mucus is swallowed, it effectively acts as a biochemical Trojan horse. It completely shields the virions from the low pH of the stomach and delivers them directly to that highly permissive, ANPEP-rich, apical surface of the intestinal enterocytes.
It escorts them right past the acid moat.
Exactly. But, you know, we should talk about the limitations too, because the physical transport mechanism combined with the transcriptomic data creates an amazing picture, but it's still a lab model.
Right. We must continuously evaluate the limitations of our models. HIEs offer incredible morphological fidelity. They look and act a lot like real gut tissue.
But they are isolated.
They are isolated epithelial systems. They lack the stromal compartment, a functional enteric nervous system, and most critically, a resident microbiome.
And the microbiome is huge. It plays a massive role in modulating basal interferon signaling and just overall epithelial metabolism.
Oh, absolutely. And we're also missing circulating mucosal immunity in these models. The T cells and B cells that would typically migrate to the lamina propria during an infection, they just aren't there.
That is a significant variable. There is also the reality of interdonor variability.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a really interesting finding in the supplementary data. The team noted that one of the pediatric donor lines was highly susceptible at 37 degrees, but another pediatric line actually demonstrated partial resistance.
Wow, so not all kids' cells acted the same.
Right. The susceptible pediatric line showed a distinct immunological lag in the RNA-seq data. It just failed to upregulate antiviral genes as robustly as the other lines.
That variability just highlights that chronological age and biological age in tissue do not always perfectly align.
We all possess a unique baseline transcriptomic state. Yeah. It's influenced by genetics, environment, and our prior immunological encounters.
And furthermore, this study mapped these responses against a single clinical strain of 229E, right?
Correct.
So as variants emerge, you have to assume selective pressures could easily alter both the receptor affinity and the virus's ability to counter or evade these specific ribosomal shutdown mechanisms.
It's the constant evolutionary arms race, just playing out at a microscopic level.
Yeah. So to sum all this up for you listening at home, the susceptibility of our gut to an endemic respiratory virus isn't merely a function of how much virus you're exposed to or if the receptors match. It is strictly governed by the developmental maturity of our tissues and our core body temperature.
By leveraging their mature metabolic flexibility at higher temperatures, adult tissues effectively starve the virus.
By halting ribosomal biogenesis,
yeah,
which is a defensive mechanism that rapidly proliferating younger tissues simply cannot safely deploy.
It's a trade-off between growth and defense.
Exactly. So what does this mean for the future of targeted antiviral therapeutics? If mature cells can utilize temporary metabolic and translational shifts to effectively starve out a viral infection at the cellular level, could we one day design interventions that intentionally induce these localized metabolic bottlenecks? Could we shut down the viral assembly line before an infection can systemically disseminate? It's definitely something to think about. This episode was based on an open access article under the CCBY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe to your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Neon in the lab, midnight on the clock. We set that warm line and we let it drop. Same cell, same gate, but the world rewinds. At 32, the virus finds time. Quiet alarms and the innate reply. Less of the warning, more room to climb. Screens light up with the rising load. A cold estate and an open road. Temperature tells it when to run. Cold makes a cradle, heat stops the fun. And the enterocytes, its stakes is claimed. But at 37, it can't play the same. Turn the dial. Watch the story cut. Cold side of the gut. Cold side of the gut. Yeah. Beetle and Young still catch that wave. Adults switch gears and won't behave. Translation slows, metabolism bends. Stress past signals draw the ends. One receptor, one lock and pep on the door. Protease like a razor, it wants a little more. But camelstat cuts the spark mid-flight. Shut down entry, fade out the bite. Woo! Temperature tells it when to run. Cold makes a cradle, heat stops the fun. And the enterocytes, its stakes is claimed. But grown up heat won't feed the flame. Turn the dial, let the data erupt. Woo!
cold side of the gut. Cold side of the gut.